Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer and welcome to the CRE Shark Eye Show, where we discuss commercial real estate. On Mondays, we dive deep into an asset class, and on Thursdays, we go into some inspirational stories for the weekend. Can't wait to start. Let's go. Hey guys, before we continue, I would like to introduce you to the 7-Day CRE Challenge, which will introduce you to commercial real estate and will show you that anyone can do this. Also, I have the free cheat sheet for commercial real estate with the 6 best secrets for commercial real estate. You can download it free. Just click below or above, wherever it is, and get it. Let's continue. Hey guys, this is Ishai Breslauer, the CRE Shark Eye Show, live on LinkedIn, YouTube, and my Facebook page. Also, like, subscribe, do whatever you need to do in order to get committed to this thing and help out this channel and do whatever you need to do. And also, this is the CRE Shark Eye Show podcast, going to be ripped off. I take the audio and you guys driving can hear it right now and enjoy it and whatever it is. Anyways, live and audio. So usually on Thursday, first of all, happy holidays. Today is Christmas. I know I'm a Hanukkah guy. I'm a Jewish, but everyone who's celebrating Christmas, you should have Merry Christmas, whatever you call it. And you should enjoy it. Enjoy the holiday. Happy holidays to everyone and whatever you guys are celebrating. Enjoy the holidays. Enjoy it with your family. It's so, so important. On Thursdays, especially on a holiday, I try to make things lighter and less technical. But I have a great guest today, and I want to bring him on the show. And the guest today is Andy Basali. Andy Basali is a real estate developer from New York. He's a friend of mine. And he's a great guy and also a very talented person, a very self-driven young man. And he's going to tell us all kinds of things that he's doing and how he started up. And I'm very excited about this. And so you guys stick around and listen, and I'm going to bring him on the show. So here we go. And without further ado, here is Andy. Andy, how are you, my friend?
How are you? Good to see you. Long time.
It's good to have you. Thank you.
Very long time. Pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
My pleasure. How are you doing out there?
How's
it going in New York? How do you say?
Weather got better. We had a little bit of a snow snap this past week.
Yeah, I know.
But the weather's much better now, thank God. And we're doing good. We're doing all right.
Sounds good. So how are you doing nowadays?
We're in a hold pattern. We don't know what we're doing right now. We're watching to see.
It makes all of us. Everybody who's listening, it makes me. It makes everyone who's listening to the show. Everybody else. And by the way, guys, if you have some comments and you want to ask questions, you can put them in the comments, and I can ask Andy if you have something that is coming up. But I want to start, Andy. You know, we know each other for a little while, as we call it, and we enjoyed each other's companies and conversations and try to do some stuff together. And please God, in the future, we will do stuff together.
Amen.
One thing I want to do today is I try to be inspired. You know, I try to bring inspirational stories, and your story is pretty cool. And I want you to tell us how you started up. How the business started up without you, and how you joined or started your own thing, your own gig, and how you're swimming out there in New York, and so on. But let's start from the very beginning. Shoot, let's go.
Sure. I went to school in Boston. I graduated with a degree in finance and business management. Coming out of school, I was looking for a job in investment banking, financing, whatever it was. And at that time, there wasn't a lot available to me in New York. There were some offers I got in Boston, but I wanted to really be back in New York. And I didn't want to go start working with my father just yet. So I started working with a brokerage company in Manhattan called City Habitats, who at the time, and even now, they're still pretty active. They were the largest rental brokerage company then. I really got to start learning about Manhattan's rental market. They had a great training program. We got to learn about the big landlords, how the rental business works, both from the broker side and from the renter side, with the kind of fees.
And this is all in Boston.
No, this is in New York. This is me coming back.
Right. Okay.
Right. I did the brokerage for about a year, year and a half, and I just got tired of dealing with these people looking for like the perfect apartment that didn't exist. You know, people wanting to pay like $1,500 for this.
Similar to me, my man. I'm not a resident.
For like the price of a couple.
I want to tell you something that's so amazing that you're saying it, because I've done it for 3 years. I've done it for 3 years, maybe a little more, with a residential. You know, I was selling luxury condos, and at the time, I was meeting with everybody and so on. So I enjoyed the meetings with people, but I enjoyed more the conversation than selling the apartments, which I did pretty okay. Meaning I was good at it, but I'm saying it was more interesting to talk to the people and see what they're doing and how they're doing mega businesses and real estate and M&As and all kind of things like that. And I was less excited about what I did at the time. And then I figured what commercial real estate can do and how interesting it is. And I always joked that it was harder for me to sit with Mrs. So-and-so that is telling me about the jacuzzi that has to move from here to there, versus $100 million developer. And I could understand him and have a great report just like that, and people looked at me and say, "You're insane. This is so much easier." I said, "No, this is easier for me. This is more interesting to me." And that's how it is. So keep on going. I could relate.
Very similar for me. I didn't enjoy the dealing with the people and their personalities and their nitpickiness. I don't like the light in this room. My windows are too small. It wasn't for me. So I joined my father about a year and a half later. My father had been building or has been building in New York for about 50 years now. He has a degree in architecture from Iran. He got his degree in architecture in Iran. He did some projects there.
Right, I remember.
He immigrated to America in the late 70s. And with some startup money, he started building
single that was the time everybody home, came.
Multifamily homes in Queens, a little bit in Long Island. And 3 years, he got bigger and bigger projects. His largest project was like an 80-unit building, condominium building in Queens, which went bust eventually, unfortunately. But, that's real estate. You have up markets, down markets. So I joined him in about, 2004, I joined him. And day one, I was going to construction sites. I didn't know how to hold a pair of blueprints. I didn't know any of the lingo. I was meeting with, plumbers that have been in business for 40 years. They're asking me questions, and I don't know what to tell them. I said, I don't know.
That's how you start everything.
And you just get thrown into the pot, and you learn to swim. And that's what I did. I started learning. I'd spend anywhere from like 2 hours to 4 hours a day on the construction site, learning every single trade, what they did, what to look for, what not to look for. My dad would come give me advice. He'd, tell me, "All right, this is not right. They should have done this," or "This is good. This, watch what he's doing. He knows what he's doing." And, you'd meet with architects and learn how to read the blueprints, and you'd meet with the plumber and the electrician, and you'd understand about wiring. And from each trade, you'd pick up a little bit. And I think that was probably the most important part of my, of the beginning of my career, is just learning on site. Nothing will replace on site learning or in the business learning. University is great. They teach you from big books, fancy professors, but it's all theory. It's not practical application that you're using on the site.
Tell me something very, very cool. I want to ask you, I'm very curious about this. And also a lot of people that are listening to us are beginners or people who want to get excited about commercial real estate and want to learn about real estate development and all that stuff. I want to ask you something. What was, when you walked around those sites in the very, very beginning, try to walk, try to think back, what was the hardest thing to learn? And what was the thing that you thought that you had to learn? And that was very, how do you say, the most important thing for your professional growth? What was that thing? Or maybe two things or three things.
Right. So I'm not the typical developer. I wear two hats. I'm a general contractor. So I build myself. I'm my own GC. I do the construction. We manage our own construction projects. Right. And I act as a developer. I source the land and I buy it and I find it. So on the developer side, the hardest part was getting information. We didn't have all the information at the tip of our fingers You couldn't go on to a website, you know, you pay $10 a month and you get all the information you need. I have to travel down to this city, get the city records, look up the zoning. I'd have to go learn the zoning, have to talk to architects on the phone. What can I build here? How big can I build? So that process was very difficult. And I ended up taking classes at a local universities in Brooklyn where I could just learn about the zoning in New York City and where to get more information, what offices within the city could answer my questions. Conversely, those were actually the most profitable times in the business. The less information is available.
And where do you get it today? What do you do today for that? Tell everybody.
Right on the computer, there's 100 websites. You can get all the information you want.
Which one is your favorite? Which one is your favorite?
I use the Zola. Zola is the city. The New York City created a website called Zola.
Yeah.
Zola NYC, and you know they give you everything you need to know about
everything. Yes.
Everything. When that information wasn't available, no one knew what their property was worth. But now that everyone knows what their property is worth, much harder to find a deal. So that was one thing. The second thing with terms of construction was really understanding the details, the technical parts of the construction, how things were supposed to go together, how it was supposed to be done, you have to know better than the person doing it how it's supposed to be done. And in your first 2 years, how are you supposed to know better than the guy on the site how it's supposed to be done? So again, I went to NYU. I took evening courses, how to read construction.
Which courses you took?
I took a few of them. I took, analyzing commercial real estate deals. I took a blueprint reading course, how to read blueprints. I took courses on construction methods, both exterior and interior construction methods and means of construction. So we had, you know, very high level executives coming in and telling us how construction works, what the typical industry standards are. Things like that. I started getting my license with the city in terms of being a licensed general contractor. That required courses I had to take, so I was taking more courses for that. I invested a lot in courses and learning. Much like what your listeners are doing right now. You have to really.
How important is it?
Without learning, now it's easy. You could just go online and read and learn everything. You can become a wizard online. But back then, I'd have to drive to the city or drive here. And go
I can buy a course. That's it. That's what we do. Tell me something. I want to ask you something. This is something that I want to hear your perspective. I know my perspective on that. And you are a guy who is a developer / GC. You're a general contractor and a developer. CM, GC, you're everything.
Yeah.
Okay? And I wore a hat of a developer, not a GC, of course, and definitely not a CM, but a construction management, meaning, of course, that's what I mean for everybody who's asking what it is. But my question to you is, you told us what's the difference, okay? But if you're a developer, how much do you have to know about construction in your opinion? I know you're both. It's hard for you to put that hat, but I know my answer, but what would you answer? How much do you have to know and what would you do in order to function properly as a developer who is building and who is not a GC?
Let me preface your question with this. In a good market that's going up like this, you don't have to know much. You have to know land plus building equals finished product, and I sell it and I make money. And in an up market, you don't have to know much and you can do it. In a down market, it makes all the difference. And the reason is a developer that doesn't understand the construction project and the costs associated with it and the issues they'll see coming up is almost fighting a battle with one arm. When you really understand construction and the issues and the logistics of the site, the things that can go wrong at the site, you become much more picky at what you put your money in, and you're much more you're more refined in your approach to analyzing your deals. There's a lot of little nuances that you don't think about, and I'm still learning that. Every new project comes with new challenges.
Exactly. Everybody learns all the time.
And it's
But let me disagree with you just a little bit to make it interesting for the show, you know. In my opinion, you're right, and at the same time, I disagree a little bit. You're right because you have to know everything you said in the down market and up market. First of all, I look at every deal individually. Down market, up market, every deal stands alone. Of course, in the down market, it's much harder, but a lot harder, and sometimes even impossible. But as a developer, and this is the important part, you, and I think that your perspective is coming from, meaning you have your perspective because you are both. Mm-hmm. And you're saying, how could you do that without knowing much about that? But I know developers who build hundreds of millions of dollars, and you know them too, of stuff. And they are not necessarily construction people. They are not coming from there. They know some stuff, but they don't know bits and pieces and details. They don't know how to conduct and how to run the orchestra of construction, as we call them. And but they do know how to hire the right people. So, and that's the point where I am a little different. So I think that you have this advantage, which is huge, to be both, right? You're both. But I think that a guy who is a developer, and that's the way to scale, knows how to hire the right people who he could trust. Of course, you have to know a certain thing, okay? But it's mostly knowing how to put down the numbers and knowing who to hire. It's less about the how, it's more about the who. That's my opinion.
That's correct. That's correct. On your first project, you know, as a starting developer, you're going to make a mistake. You know, finding that person that you trust will take time, as with anything.
Yes.
That's the hard part, finding the right guy. You know, if you find him on your first shot, great. But you might go through three or four different construction management companies until you find one that really, really does the right job for you and you can trust. Yeah,
especially when you're small. When you're big, it's easier because many of them are really good. When you're small, many of them are not. And
the larger the project, the better quality type of contractors you're going to get to. You know,
exactly.
At the $100-200 million level, there's a few guys that can do the job.
Exactly.
At $2-3 million level, there's thousands of people that can do the job, and you get a higher percentage of.
And your due diligence have to be more crazy about who you're taking. Yes.
Right. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. A developer is really, they're more of like the quarterback. They see all the different parts. They don't have to be an expert at any specific part. Maybe just underwriting has to be their expertise. Even that they can hire out to get like a good analyst that can do the numbers for them. But they have to really be able to put together a team of the best people, the best analyst, the best construction management team. A guy that can get them the financing. They have to know investors. You know, I think a developer's biggest asset is investors, or finding the money. A developer has to really find the money and find the deal.
We'll talk about it in a second. I want to ask you something else beforehand. Meaning, I want to talk about the syndication and the raising of the capital. That's a different aspect. I want to get that. But beforehand, I want to ask you another question about being a developer. Everybody's asking a question, and I pretty much know the answer. I want to hear your perspective on that. But what is the division between having an outsourced team, which is huge in real estate, okay, and an in-house team? Meaning, how many people would you say, meaning you don't have to reveal how many people you have in the office, but I'm saying in an ideal company, how many people you would need in-house and how many, meaning, and that's it, because outsourcing is everybody else. It's the engineer, CMs, GCs, everything. And if you do it yourself in an open book, and then you have all the subcontractors and everybody else, it's like a zoo. So I'm saying, who is inside the house as a developer? I'm not talking about GC. I know you're a GC also. So
I think that's a hard question. You know, there's development
very hard.
With 20, 30 people on staff, there's people with two or three, you know, like me. I don't have really a large staff because I really just do everything in-house myself. I know, you know, most of the parts myself. But I'd say the average company in New York would need four or five guys at minimum. You need an analyst that's just analyzing deals all day. you need someone that's kind of overseeing construction or kind of focusing on the construction aspect of it. Mm-hmm. You need another guy that's sourcing deals, finding the deals, disposing of the deals, either getting the refinancing done, dealing with the bank, and someone that's really in touch with the investors, whether that's the head of the company or it's one of the, you know, is raising capital.
Someone answers the calls, was always available, very important.
Yeah. So I think five guys, you know, those are the major parts of the puzzle. It's great money, point. Construction, deal sourcing, and analysis.
Awesome point. Okay, so let's move on to a little bit of the, you know, the one challenge every operator, developer, owner, CEO has, and that is the part of the capital. Meaning we have the part of running the show, which you're doing, mm-hmm. and being the general partner, what we call, and then we have the part of bringing in the cash, bringing in the capital in order to have a project. So if you could tell us a little bit more of your experience, what do you think about it, and how you started with that, and from your father to you, and how is it?
Well, my father and I have always been together, so any money we've raised has really been in unison with each other. At our level, you know, under $20 million projects, we're usually raising the equity portion of the development. You know, you have equity and debt. I don't know, for the listeners yes. out there, how well-versed they are in the capital stacks. But the equity, we're usually raising from within family, friends, people we know in the industry, people like you, Ishai. You know, you go to you know, people in the industry, colleagues that you have a relationship with, and you tell them, I'm looking to raise $2 million, $4 million, $5 million, and the rest, you know, construction loan. Working with my father, I was very lucky to have his reputation, both friends and family-wise, but not only that, but also on the debt side, you know, he'd had relationships, and we still continue to have the same relationships with banks that he's been doing business with for over 15, 20 years now, that trust us, that'll you know, come into our deals just because they know we have the wherewithal to complete them. And that's a major component for any bank. They want to make sure you can get the job done, you have the experience, and that you know, good market or bad market, you can pull it through.
100%.
And on the equity side, the same thing. The equity side, anyone that invests with you, first they want to see on construction especially a higher return than 5 to 10%. You know, no one's going to put their money into construction for 5-10%.
Exactly.
You gotta show them how you're going to get them there.
And in a timely fashion. Yeah. And in a timely fashion.
And they're not looking to be married to the project indefinitely. They like to get in and out on the condo deals. On rentals, you know, longer term holds, 5-10 years. But right. They also want to know what you've done. What were your returns on your last project? How many of these have you done? You know, how well do you know the market? Show me how you come to this conclusion. And you can analyze something and have a 20-page, you know, Excel sheet with all the numbers and everything, and you can read it. But showing 100%. It to some guy that's in a exactly. different business, that's in he has a fruit stand, or he's in jewelry, or in the automotive business, you have to be able to translate all those fancy numbers into something they can read. That's probably one of the biggest and hardest challenges of raising money from, I don't want to say unsophisticated, but you know, friends and family type investors, people that are not experts in the business, that aren't analysts.
You know, something that's in the end, just one comment about this. In the end, it's everybody. And I'll tell you why. You know, we share the same struggle of doing that and raising and going around. And I want to tell you, that's everyone. And people say unsophisticated. It's a term, but it's not a correct term, because today you have so many sophisticated people who are not really familiar, I would call it, with the commercial real estate, you know, pro forma, you know, to go and look at the numbers and see what the numbers say. They look at the numbers because they've seen many businesses. Some of them are even accountants, and they know how to look at things that me and you are not going to be able to look at, you know. But when it comes to that, due to the fact that real estate is so unique when it comes to numbers, it's so different. It's such a different it's a different business. They need that translation, like you just said. You know, they need that you know, someone to tell them, what does that mean? What does this mean? And all the terms are different, you know, from EBITDA to NOI. And, you know, all these things are really different. But at the same time, people, like you said, yes, they want to hear how the results are going to come. And many times the PDF, and we're getting right all those PDFs from all the brokers, and how beautiful they are, huh?
They look great on paper. Then you start analyzing them and the questions start coming.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there are very good brokers out there. It's just that to do the work, it requires, you know, to do the due diligence requires a lot more. Just like, that's what it is. I want to ask you something. When you are now looking at deals, okay? When you're now looking at deals, let's talk pre-COVID for a second, okay? We'll get to COVID. Pre-COVID, you're in New York. You're walking around New York. And you're looking at stuff. What were you looking for? What was the typical deal you would be looking for?
Right. So my bread and butter has always been, you know, the condominium development. I'm a condo developer, residential, you know, anywhere from 10 apartments to 20, 30, 40 apartments. That was my main business, specializing in Queens, Brooklyn, Northern Manhattan. And we would look, you'd analyze the deals based on a price per development foot. How much is it per buildable foot? You know, how much are they asking? How much can you build? Take the amount they're asking divided by how many feet you can build. And that number is basically a standard for each area. You know, X part of Queens, you're paying $100 a foot. In this part of Brooklyn, you're paying $200 a foot. In that part of Northern Manhattan, it's $300 a foot. That's basically how you would approach each deal. And that's pre-COVID, that's what we were doing. We were looking at areas, how much per foot is the market, and how much per foot can we pay? If we can get it 20, 15, 20% cheaper than the market, we jump on it.
Right.
Really, it was very hard to find those kind of deals. Because it was such a efficient market. Everyone was looking. There wasn't an owner of property that wasn't getting phone calls from multiple brokers. So we were very cautious in our diligence, in our approach to underwriting. We weren't underwriting with these, you know, long-term forecasts of 20% growth in the condo market every year. We always have been very conservative, which has helped us in these kind of markets, in the COVID markets, in the down markets, in the crashes.
Right. And I think also, by the way, sorry for interrupting you, but I think that that's also a reflection of how the markets changed over time, meaning they were in a certain place, very hot, very exciting, and all of a sudden it became really less exciting right before COVID. I think that COVID brought the reality, you know, sometimes things happen and they bring up real things that are happening already, okay? And what I wanted to ask you here is, when COVID hit, what happened? What did you do? What was your first reaction in terms of, okay, you're looking at deals, you're checking that deal, you're in the middle of acquisition, maybe you're in the middle of that and this, and boom, COVID hit. Where are you? Where's Andy?
Right. So Andy was in the middle of two construction projects.
Where? Queens?
Yeah. One of them is in Queens. One was in Queens, mid-construction. We were actually towards the end, we were getting our CVO, which for the viewers means certificate of occupancy, which is basically a legal document stating that people can start living here now. You can sell these units. People can live there. They can be occupied. So we were building four multifamily homes. And we were trying to get – I'm sorry. I got someone coming to do some small work, so I got to let them in.
No problem.
We were in the middle of getting our CVO on – four homes, COVID hit, city shut down. We couldn't get anything done. We couldn't have our final inspections done. So I wasn't really looking for new deals. I was trying to get what I had on the table done. I was paying interest to the bank. So I was scrambling, trying to find out how I can get these things completed, you know, get their CFO, start selling them. I had two other
projects. How did that go?
We're in contract, but we sold one actually this week. Two more are in contract. We should be closing within the next 2 or 3 weeks on those. And we have one more left, hopefully looking to sign a contract in the next few days. We also had a project we were building for someone, for a small developer in Brooklyn. We got that done just before COVID, and they were able to get the CFO right before, in the middle of COVID, they were able to get CFO. As COVID started, you know, settling in April, May, they were able to get their CFO. And we have two other projects currently where we've been trying to get permits. We started before COVID started to get the approvals, and we're still trying to get the approvals on those. In terms of looking for new deals, we've, you know, the market's changed. You know, people are not jumping to buy condominiums in Brooklyn and Queens anymore. Give me one moment while I just help someone with something right now.
No problem. In the meantime, let me just gather a few things for everybody who's listening. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the life of a developer, guys. He has to do things. You know, yes, especially a GC, a guy who's a contractor, all kind of things come up, especially during the daytime. That's how it is. It's a different type of life. It's very, you know what, everything you say is so, so interesting. What I wanted to ask you is, not only how you experienced it, but you obviously are in touch with all kind of people who are doing whatever you're doing, which is real estate development in all kind of ways and forms and so on and so forth, in all kind of sizes, big, small, medium, whatever it is. What are they experiencing in terms of condo development and sales of the condos, meaning with the brokers from the area and everything that is going around? What is your experience? What do you hear? And I'm talking about now shifting a little bit from COVID, meaning I know everybody was like, you know, frozen. Nobody does anything. People don't buy. People don't move. But right now, we're, even though we are, some of us, going into like a second quarantine, third quarantine, whatever it is, shutdowns, in our head, in our psychology, we're getting out of this. Okay, mm-hmm. There's a vaccine. We know that there's a light in the end of the tunnel. We hope that, okay, very much. And we already into that, people had enough. So my question is, what now? Do you see people actually buying condos?
I don't see a lot of that. Especially not in Manhattan, not in parts of Brooklyn. You know, there is transactions happening. I don't want to say there's none, but it's at a significantly lower pace and volume than when we were seeing pre-COVID. Even before COVID in 2019, Brooklyn especially had seen about a 10% decrease in sales prices on a price per square foot basis. Volume-wise, there was a slight decrease in volume. Now I'd say that's almost 30-40% less in terms of volume, and dollar value as well is probably 20% lower. In Queens, I'm not really that sure. I haven't really... There are parts of Queens that are still strong, like Astoria, Queens is still very good. Long Island City is still
active. What would you say the price per square foot is, like today in the more high-end places?
Right. So like, let's say
Queens and Brooklyn I'm talking about.
Bushwick, Brooklyn, which I was very active in. Condos were selling anywhere between like $800 to $900 a square foot. Nowadays, you might get somewhere between $700 and $800 a foot. On condominiums.
What about those which were selling for $1,100, $1,300?
$1,000 a foot. That would be for a little bit better areas of Brooklyn, maybe.
Dumbo, maybe all those. Yeah.
Dumbo would be even higher, like $1,100, $1,200.
Yeah. Dumbo is.
Maybe the Dumbo secondary part. $1,000.
Depends what. Right.
Williamsburg, not the prime waterfront, but you know, further central. Williamsburg was around $1,000 a foot to $1,100. those prices have come down probably anywhere to like 900 a foot. I haven't really studied it, but I think you'd see a probably $100 a foot decrease there, which is like 10%, maybe even more. It's 15% depending on how desperate the developer is. In parts of Queens, there's been a slight decrease in like Astoria. Like I said, Astoria is just north of Long Island City, a very strong neighborhood. Hasn't seen a huge decrease, but the volume is reduced. You know, like the prices are still there, but where you were selling maybe per quarter,
people can't sell for less. That's why, I guess, right? And people understand that
they don't need to sell; they can just hold. They're not struggling. But a developer that's got a construction loan and they're paying interest and they have to get the product units off their books, they're gonna either have to sell, or if they reduce their price too much, they'll lose. They're looking to their bank to kind of negotiate something. You know, listen, the market's changed. The value of my units are not what they were. You know, my one bedrooms were worth $650,000. Now they're worth $550,000. You have to give me a reduction on my mortgage so I can get out of this.
How are the banks? Are they working with you?
So I actually had this similar issue. I had, you know, the four houses. I had a few million-dollar construction loan on them. The bank didn't reduce the amount I owed them, but in terms of payment, they deferred payments. Almost up to 9 months now they've deferred, and we just started paying that down. So they worked with us with payments, but they didn't reduce the rate. They didn't reduce the balance, which, yeah. We didn't see such a decrease in our neighborhood. We only saw like less than 10% decrease. So we still got out of the game all right.
Just an interesting perspective. I had a conversation with someone who called me. And he has a fund that they buy condos in distressed, meaning they buy from developers. They found this niche in places that are distressed in terms of condos, and they buy bulks of condos from developers.
Yeah,
and they just buy them very, very cheap. In order, that's their investment, and then they just keep them and they rent it out, and then they sell them after a while. But they wait for the market to go up. And that's that's sort of a huge, huge fund. So there are funds like that that do that because they take advantage of the markets and what the market did. There's a question here from Alicia Friedman, and Wow, you saw that?
No, I'm just saying hi because I assume she's watching.
Alicia. He's asking the following. He says, is there a good software that you use to organize all prospective deals, such as a CRM or a deal pipeline software? Is there something like that? He's asking.
I don't
That's
use
a good any question, by the way.
Yeah, I don't use a specific software. I usually organize my deals or the prospective deals that I'm looking at. I usually put it in an Excel sheet. I'll have one tab for Brooklyn, one tab for Queens, another tab for Northern Manhattan, let's say. And I'll, you know, just type in my notes there and, do my analysis in Excel. I'm heavily using Excel most of the time. I don't have a software that I really use for analyzing or tracking deals. Usually you'll have like brokers using a software, you know, brokers are more attuned to using a software to keep in track of your clients.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So that's my answer. Also, usually brokers are dealing with a lot more stuff than the developers, because developers, operators, doesn't matter. Anyone who is buying properties is buying real estate. The perspective is usually, and talking from experience, meaning that's what we did. And, that's our lives. When you talk about coming in and seeing all kind of stuff coming in, you're having a lot of deals coming in, and that's my two cents here. If you have another input, please say it. But from my perspective, is when things are coming in, there's all kind of tiers to how to do diligence. There's the preliminary, and then there's the deeper. And in the preliminary, you have maybe five or six steps. When you get a deal and you look at certain lines, meaning when I get this huge deck, right? You get this huge deck. And today we get it in the computer. We don't get it in a hand. You get this huge deck. There's that place, and that's what I'm saying to people who are not so familiar, you know, with this field and want to get into commercial real estate, because people who know they know how to do that. But what we do is usually we go to the last line, and I learned it from Warren Buffett, you know, reading a lot of books from him. I know exactly what I'm looking for. And if it doesn't fit either, I don't know if it's a good deal or a bad deal, but first of all, you look if it fits your criteria. And then the second step comes, if it fits your criteria, is it interesting enough or not? And then you start going in. So you don't have to use too many. If you have a larger company, then you'll have an Excel or a CRM or something, because you don't want to have deals that come from, you know, this broker and that broker and the same deal, and that's why you have to do it. But in smaller companies, it's easier to keep track. And if deals are not interesting, they just fly out the window. So it doesn't matter who's bringing them. So that's the 2 cents I have. I hope that helps. But anyways, Andy, I want to get back a little bit and I want to ask you a question. You have experience in the boroughs in New York, right?
Mm-hmm.
In terms of getting permits, and we spoke about this right beforehand, getting permits today is much harder. Okay, you said that. And
yeah.
I want to ask you, can you make a comparison between Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens, and the rest of the New York, you know, the five boroughs?
For people that are not familiar with New York, New York City is composed of five boroughs, which is the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Manhattan, and Staten Island. The process and the rules and the regulations that apply to all five of these boroughs are the same. If you know the rules that apply to a project, for building a project in Queens, those same rules will apply to a project in Manhattan, Brooklyn, or Queens. So the process will be the same, and the amount of time it takes will vary slightly because each borough processes their own applications at a different speed. You know, Brooklyn might have 200 projects that need to get approved, and Staten Island might only have 10 projects to get approved. So it might be a little bit faster in Staten Island, but the procedure and the calculations and the drawings the standards and the regulations that you have to adhere to, which is called zoning and building code, those are the same throughout New York City. You know, the fire code, the occupancy regulations and requirements, those are all the same throughout all of New York City, throughout the five boroughs. So if you know the zoning for New York City, you can technically understand how something has to get designed through any of the five boroughs.
Tell me something. That's a great answer. Tell me something. Today, when you want to run, want to expedite this whole thing, you obviously do it yourself, I'm assuming. How would you sum it up in simple words, you know, the process that you go through and how, in order to make it faster than slower? Why? Because you have the experience, you learn on your skin what it takes to make it, to get it done. So what would you put in terms of your action plan when it comes to that?
To tell you that I can get it done faster than the average person would be a lie. I really can't. A big part of getting your project approved is the architect that you use. And
I knew you were going to say that.
you would think that the bigger the architect, you know, the bigger staff they have, the larger office, the more they charge, the faster they can get your project done. But you have to be careful of two things. When an architect is too busy and they have too many projects, just another number in their list of projects that has to get done. So sometimes you're waiting on your architect.
Unless they have the right amount of staff.
Yes. And then, well, if you find an architect that's not so busy, they have the time, they usually don't have that much staff, so they're trying to handle everything themselves. So you're also beholden to how much he can handle that, or she can handle, your architect can handle.
And then you got the zoning lawyer.
There's no clear answer on that. If I knew, You know, you're always searching for an architect that has the capability, that has the staff that can get your project done quick. But the city is changing every single day with regards to their laws, their zoning, their new codes they come up with. The newest code that's been added to the New York City's, you know.
Yeah, how is it
about book? How is it? It's about something like the size of 4 or 5 books of the Talmud. That's how maybe 10 books of Talmud. That's what an architect has to know in order to get a project approved. They've just added, as of I think,
that's incredible.
They've added an energy code to make New York City's buildings more energy efficient. This has become the newest battle in the war on getting permits approved. You can go back and forth with the city maybe 5 or 6 times over just how the energy is being calculated, how the building has to get designed to reduce the amount of energy being used, and it's become a major part of the approval process, which has made it much more difficult to get projects approved in a faster time.
And tell me something from pre-COVID, COVID, and now, where are we in permits? Meaning, what changed?
A lot of stuff has where it was done in person now is just being done completely online now.
Is it the processing and the bureaucracy or the building codes? Meaning, how would you put it?
The building code has definitely gotten harder and harder. Even though they refined the zoning and they made it simpler, supposedly, it's just gotten harder and harder. They've added more layers to it. That's one part of it. Then there's the interpretation. Your architect interprets those codes and regulations one way, and the city, they call them plan examiners, the people that work in the city, the plan examiner interprets it their way. It's not black and white all the time. So there's this back and forth between your architect and the city as to what the appropriate way is to approach this code or this requirement or this ordinance. And that back and forth is really the hard part. It's, you know, you're trying to maximize your building, trying to maximize profitability, trying to reduce your costs. So you don't want to you're trying to get your project approved with the least amount of requirements and regulations the city wants to put in place. For example, I'm designing a new building. The city came back to me asking me to do a camera inspection of the sewers. Now, I'd built already a building on this block. I didn't have to inspect the sewer before with a camera to see what was or how big the sewer pipe was. So I went to my architect and said, why are they asking this? Long story short, it ends up that the surveyor had the wrong size of the sewer on the survey that they created. So I went back to my surveyor and said, listen, this is not correct. The sewer is really 8 inch, it's not 6 inch. Update your survey. So he had to update his survey. We send that back to the city. And now we're waiting to see this if the city will let us get away with this camera inspection without doing the camera inspection. That camera inspection might take me a month to get done. It cost me $4,000 or $5,000.
Crazy.
These are little things that hold you up, that cost you extra, and that set
it adds up. It all adds up. Sure. That's crazy. Sure. Yes, sure. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. Tell me something. How do you see the future for you, for yourself, for Andy? Where are you going?
I really don't know right now.
That's a great answer. Everybody's saying it.
Yeah. The business that I've become accustomed to, the condo market, buy, build, sell, that model's been challenged with COVID. People are moving out of the densely populated areas, I think permanently, into the more suburban, more spread out areas. They're looking for more space. They're looking for a little bit more privacy. Whether it's working from home or working from an office that's less populated, you know, in these more suburban areas, that means less people are looking to buy condos or even rent in the urban areas. Mm-hmm. And so my focus has to now shift on those migratory patterns. Where are people moving to? How are they going to change their lifestyle? Realistically, it's very much a focus on how people live and accommodating that lifestyle of theirs. How you're building a product, and you're really marketing it to someone based on how they live or how you perceive them to be living. Do they right. want to be in a building with another 20, 30 residents? Do they want to be in a building where they have to share an elevator with four or five other people at the same time?
Exactly. These are repeating questions.
You know, previously, if your building didn't have a gym, no one would buy in it. Now a gym might be a liability. You know, they don't want to go run on a treadmill that other people were running on.
Right.
So analyzing and really, really understanding my new market, the demographic shift, the market shift, I think that's the key to it. And it's going to take me not a long time, but it's going to take me time to understand how people's lives are changing and what they're looking for now, as opposed to what they were looking for before COVID started.
Exactly. A lot of things changed in the world. Share with us, you know, before we finish, one major, you don't have to say details, but, you know, a feeling or a small piece of major success that you felt and the major setbacks, a failure that you learned from, you know, both that got you to grow.
My one, let's say, setback. I think right now I'm kind of in a setback mode right now. I'm seeing how the market's changed, and I haven't been fast enough to adopt to it. And that's the key, I think, really, to any business, is adopting fast enough. The market is always going to change no matter what business you're in, not just in real estate. An excellent I think case study I like to point to always is Polaroid camera. Polaroid camera was the king of the hill, the top of the photography industry, you know,
right,
gratification. And they didn't adopt to the market.
Yes.
The king became the peasant all of a sudden. They lost out. They're not really there anymore. You have these digital cameras now that are all the bells and whistles you can want. And Polaroid lost out because they didn't have they call it the pulse on the market. They didn't understand how people, their tastes were changing. And that's where I am right now. The market's changing. The taste is changing. And I'm, I think, a little bit slow to that. I got to really catch up and kind of see where the next step is
going
to be.
Where the pack is going. And that's, I spoke about, right. For all the listeners, we spoke about, you know, I think it was the last show where we're going in 2021. If you want to, you can hear it yourself. But didn't cover, I would say, specifics, but we spoke a little bit about all kind of markets that people are going to. And that is an interesting perspective. That's something to take into consideration. And a lot of people are talking about it. So, yeah.
And one of the successes you asked about was one of our larger buildings. It was a 22-unit condominium in an area called Bayside, Queens. It was an area with almost no new development. There was certainly very little condominiums. So you couldn't get an idea of what your expected sellout would be because there was nothing to compare it against. There was no benchmark. All we knew is that it was a good area. It was near, you know, there was a train that would take you to the city pretty quickly. And we took a risk. We built a really nice product, something that didn't exist in the market. And we were lucky in that the market actually grew. It kind of shot up during the time we were building. And it became one of the most successful projects we've ever built in an area that had never seen more than $500, $600 a foot. We ended up selling out at around $850, $900 a foot. And
good times.
Good times. a major factor of that was that we went to an area where people weren't really going to, and we were kind of pioneering that area in terms of condo development. Now you see a lot more development around here. Not that there's availability of land, but people are have their eyes set on it if they know the areas well enough.
Right.
And so that was one of our big successes.
May you have a lot more of those.
I hope so.
And everybody is listening. So, Andy, listen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Yishai.
And I really, really appreciate your time. I really appreciate your time. If you could stick around just 1 second, I'm going to get you off the streaming, and I'm going to say a couple of things to the people and then say goodbye. But I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions, schmoozing, being offline. So if you could stick around for just a minute.
Absolutely.
So officially, I would say thank you so much. And
it was a pleasure.
It's amazing to hear from a guy who's a developer and a contractor and to hear firsthand what's going on in the New York area. That was really, really valuable. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Okay, sure. No problem. Take care. And have a great weekend and a good Shabbos. Take care of yourself. Shabbos. Just 1 second. So, guys, I just want to tell you that was a great show with Andy. And I appreciate his time. I appreciate this exciting experience. And what I want to tell you is if you're celebrating Christmas, have a Merry Christmas. If you're celebrating Shabbos, have a good Shabbos. Have a great weekend. Whatever you're going to have it and enjoy it and have a good time. And don't forget to check the links. You know, if you're watching, if you're listening to the podcast, look at the links. If you're in YouTube, look at the links, and et cetera, et cetera. I still encourage people who are beginners. I want to tell you a couple of things that are coming up in my world, things that are coming up in our world. First of all, next week, on Monday, we're going to have Michael Mintz, who is also a real estate operator and a management company, et cetera. And we're going to hear exciting stuff about the market, what's going on in New York and other areas, because he's spread out in all kind of markets. And we're going to hear his perspective. And that would be very exciting coming up. Another thing I want to tell you, I have my course, the CRE Launchpad course for beginners, whoever wants to get into the market. It's a less than 60 days. You can get that. You can check that. I'm going to leave a link below. And also, I'm working on a 7-day challenge, guys, a 7-day challenge for people who don't know the market that much, who don't know real estate, you know, commercial real estate that much, and want to understand the benefits of this. This is something that I made, something really, really cheap and small for 7 days, great lessons for $27. So that's something that's coming up. And with that, I'm ending the show. And I want to tell you, enjoy your weekend, enjoy your Shabbos, enjoy whatever. Relax, have a good time. We had a great guest today. We're going to have an amazing guest on Monday. And then again on Thursday, I'm starting to get really booked. So I'm really happy of whoever is listening to me right now. Keep on listening. Make sure you subscribe. Make sure you like. Make sure you do whatever you need to do. You share and all that stuff. Give me 5 stars if you're listening it on the podcast. You guys, take care of yourself. I'll see you next time from CRE Shakai Show. Take care. It's Yishai Breslauer. Hey, guys. Thanks for joining me in this CRE Shakai Show. I hope you enjoyed it. And go subscribe, download, do whatever you guys need to do. And I'll see you in the next episode. Take care of yourselves.